With frequent wildfires contributing to airborne pollution and the fall allergy season upon us, it's time to buttress your respiratory health with Breathe Clear from my friends at NT Factor. Breathe Clear with NT Factor combines the benefits of NT Factor's breakthrough lipids formula with powerful bioflavonoids and amino acids. Together, they've been shown to restore energy, repair the damage to cells caused by wildfire pollution, decrease allergic reactions, reduce sinus congestion, and open blood vessels. Breathe Clear with NT Factor is the best formulation available for tackling both allergies and the free radical damage caused by wildfire smoke. For a limited time, buy one container of NT Factor Lipids Powder and get a bottle of Breathe Clear with NT Factor free. That's a $27 value. Just go to ntfactor.com, that's ntfactor.com, or call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158. Arm yourself with the protective power of NT Factor Lipids Powder and get Breathe Clear with NT Factor absolutely free, and breathe freely while supporting your body's fight against allergies and free radicals. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rado Hoffman. Each week, Layla Mutin and I join together to answer your questions. Layla is our resident nutritionist. We work together in our practice here in Manhattan, seeing patients, and we share columns in the Intelligent Medicine newsletter. Layla does one of our weekly podcasts, and so we collaborate on fielding your questions that you can send to questions@drhoffman.net. And so how are you doing this week, Layla?
Okay. I'm liking the cooler weather.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really, it's suddenly fall here. But, you know, I have to say I'm and I don't want to get into a political discourse because this is not the place for it, but I'm quite upset, feelings reminiscent of 9/11.
Yeah.
After the terrible events in Israel.
Yeah.
And, suffice it to say that it is, no longer a safe world.
No.
By any means. And this has sort of shattered our aura of invincibility.
Yeah.
That such a thing could happen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually happened at exactly the same time as I was about to celebrate my birthday.
Yeah.
Which is 10/7. So heretofore, forevermore, 10/7 will be a day of infamy.
Yes.
And, just like, I feel sorry for people who were born on 9/11.
Yeah.
Well, 10/7, it's going to resonate for many, many decades, I think, as a terrible day in history. So that being said, our remit is nutrition and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's stick to the program and provide people with what they're looking for when they dial into intelligent medicine.
Yes.
So.
And then dealing with the stress component of all of these terrible events.
Yeah. And, I think in the face of challenges, and this has been my policy through my life, I've had, challenges. And I think when external events are uncontrollable, and they assail us, the one nexus that we can control often, sometimes not, is our diets, our exercise, what supplements we take, if we're fortunate enough to have access to those things. Not everybody does, because some people have a very hardscrabble existence, and their life is a struggle, and they can do nothing beyond the most bare circumstances of survival, So that's happening for a lot of people across the world, and fortunately, we can work on optimizing our lives in ways that are not accessible to other people who are more under the gun, literally and figuratively.
And we can pray.
Yes, and we can also have faith in a higher power, which is benevolent, and will take us to places other than places of religious fanaticism.
Amen.
Yeah. So anyway, that being said, because I think it's something we have to acknowledge.
Yes.
Let's focus for a moment before we get to questions. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. We have some good ones this week. And we have a leftover question from last week that I want to address. The article that I wrote for the newsletter this week is about the obesity drugs.
Yeah.
And it has what I think is the provocative title, The End of Obesity?
Uh-huh.
Question mark. And it's interesting because these drugs are so powerful that they can produce weight loss on the order of double digits and even beyond that, 20-25%.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on where you start from. I mean, if you, you know, weigh 150 pounds and you want to be 138 pounds, you know, you're not, mm-hmm. maybe not that double digit kind of weight loss. But you can, for people who are morbidly obese,
yeah.
They can lose, you know, 25% of their body mass.
Which is significant. Yeah.
Now, by the way, that is not such an uncommon occurrence here when we work with patients using natural means.
Yeah.
For example, we just saw a guy today, you know, this morning, because we record in the afternoons after mm-hmm. we've seen patients. And over the course of working with us, he was 250, now he's about 205.
Yes.
Right? And
he looks great.
And he looks great.
He feels great.
In his 60s, he's really muscular. I mean, his gym performance exceeds that of a lot of 20-somethings. And, you know, he's on a really great program. And, and it was something that he achieved very gradually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took...
It became a lifestyle.
A lifestyle, and he embraced it. And
a permanent change.
Right. And as a result, he did not suffer the consequences of some of these weight loss drugs.
Yeah.
He did not, for example, the big concern I have about these drugs, and I've enunciated this, and I think this is well known, is if you lose a lot of weight rapidly, invariably you're going to lose muscle.
Yes.
And then, you know, I didn't realize this, but I looked it up for the article, and it turns out that after 1 year, only about 34% of people who start these drugs remain on the drugs.
Huh.
Why? The expense of the drugs, which is out of control for a lot of people. They can be, you know, $15,000 a year. They just can't handle the nausea and the GI side effects of these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some people, those effects are fairly minimal. For other people, they're incapacitating.
For other people, I've heard of them say, well, I vomited, Layla. I'm
right.
Like, oh, no. Yeah.
There are other side effects such as Ozempic face, mm-hmm. you know, where people lose such a significant amount of body weight that they don't look as good. They actually, you know, their face feels, you know, looks kind of sunken in.
Yeah.
You know, and
and that's not just from weight loss. They're the joy of any eating or pleasure from it because they get nauseated or early satiety so quickly because everything is slowed down, or maybe because everything has gotten so slow that there's some putrefaction element.
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows? You're not going to be smiling, feeling like that.
It's an unhappy face.
Yeah. Or it's a face of, oh, I'm not sure,
right.
but I'm losing weight and I'm going to hang in there.
Yeah.
It's that kind of a face that I see.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, that's an interesting observation, and it kind of ties in with this. And I'm actually got an interview lined up for our podcast with a person who specializes in eating disorders and working with people who, you know, are hung up about food.
Yeah.
And she's a psychologist and psychotherapist, and her concern is that there is really a biochemical change that occurs in the brains of people who are on these medications. That's why people lose weight. They kind of lose interest in food.
Yeah.
But the pathways that are associated with desire for food are very closely related to other pathways of gratification.
Yes.
So people may lose interest in food. They may lose interest in life.
Yes.
They may develop...
No more dopamine.
Right. Exactly.
Not no more, but far less.
Yeah, and dopamine is associated with reward and gratification.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, dopamine is also associated with addiction, and there's definitely food addiction associated with a lot of people who are struggling with weight.
Yeah.
And so you curb that, but you also may top off their motivation.
Mm.
And so there is some interest now in studying the percentage of people who experience depression associated with these medications.
Yeah.
So, you know, that'll be interesting to see how that pans out. What's interesting about these drugs is they were approved based on large studies
mm-hmm.
comprising thousands of individuals
mm-hmm.
over a relatively short time. You know, usually it doesn't take, you know, 15, 20 years on a drug to get a drug approval. You know, you see rapid, sustained weight loss
mm-hmm.
without dire side effects. And by the way, there was an interesting study that is a post-marketing study. Now, pre-marketing studies are designed for approval, and they're involving a few hundred or a few thousand people. post-marketing studies take all the people who are on these things and then survey what's happening with them. And often in post-marketing studies, we see things emerging that did not appear in the pre-marketing studies for approval. Mm-hmm. And in one of the biggest post-marketing studies, I think it looked at millions of individuals, and I cite it in the article, and I recommend that you go to the newsletter and read it, and you can actually get a link there to the original article, because I provide a lot of links. Because I don't want to just, you know, where do you get that? You just made it up. No, there's a link to actual reference substantiation of what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is that there's a much higher incidence of pancreatitis. We knew that these drugs cause pancreatitis.
Uh-huh.
They also can cause what's called obstruction or ileus.
Ileus.
Which means
bowel obstruction,
which is kind of pretty devastating. I mean, it happens
to some people. That's a medical emergency.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can die. You know, you have to be hospitalized. You have to have basically an NG tube put down you.
Yes.
And then, you know, sometimes it results in one of your intestines becoming ischemic, and it may result in need to remove a part of your dead intestine.
Yeah.
So that's kind of serious, but doesn't happen very often. It happens like, you know, a very, very, very tiny percentage of the time, but it is a pretty serious side effect. So what they're saying, the conclusion by these authors is that while these side effects are rare, it may be merited to give these drugs to people with diabetes, because we know diabetes kills you.
Yeah.
And we know diabetes causes eye disease and kidney disease.
Yes.
And heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And
amputations of your toes.
Yes. So if you have that in your destiny, mm-hmm. and you can take something that reduces those risks, and it does work for diabetes, fine.
Yeah.
The small risk that you undergo, the risk-benefit equation, so-called, tilts in favor of the small risk against the potential avoidance of serious problems.
Yes.
But if you're taking it for a little more frivolous reasons, like you don't like the way you look in the mirror.
I want to lose 17 pounds.
Yeah, exactly. I've been dying now. I can't lose the weight. I really want to take these drugs.
Yeah.
So you have really no health consequences from that 17 pounds, because you can be a healthy person carrying extra weight. There is such a thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There is such a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and you're just a little chunkier than you like to be. But then you run the risk of really serious side effects, although rare, but real,
still there.
Then it's a problem.
Yeah.
So another thing, and I might have mentioned this, is that surgeons are noticing a new thing, is, you know, they take, have you ever had surgery? You ever had surgery?
I had my tonsils out when I was six.
Okay, so you don't remember. They tell you to be NPO. Nothing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, nothing per Oz.
Yeah.
Oz is Latin for mouth.
Yeah.
So it's like, or basically, you know, stop eating the day, you know, 24 hours before, then you can have clear liquids, and then you're not even supposed to have liquids. Because why? When you are under general anesthesia, there's a high risk of stomach contents upchucking.
Yes.
And then going back into your lungs. And that's called aspiration. And then you develop a very serious type of pneumonia called aspiration pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
What some of the anesthesiologists and surgeons are discovering is that people who are on these drugs have a higher propensity to aspiration pneumonia. Why? Because these drugs cause what's called gastroparesis, which means they paralyze your digestion. They slow things down.
That's
what they do. But they slow it down to the point where you may have to go off for 36 or 48 hours. So what they say is, if you're going to have a big surgery, get off the drugs. Now, it's possible to go off these drugs. These drugs are not like life-sustaining drugs,
right?
Like a heart medication.
And it's not like you would become dependent, like you'd have some kind of a
withdrawal. Oh, you're not going to
withdrawal.
Withdrawal. Yeah, exactly. You know, for some medications, you go through terrible withdrawal.
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea to keep in mind that if you're going to have general anesthesia on these drugs. So these are like some of the consequences. So there are concerns about what may be happening long-term with these drugs. Now, also, so there's societal implications. Like, well, what about the fat acceptance movement? Well, you know, fat acceptance, but what does that mean? You just don't have the resolve to take a medication that could cure you of your problem?
Mm.
You know, will there be less grossly overweight people anymore? And, you know, will it become, you know, a sign of some, you know, you're an outlier because you're still overweight. What about the weight loss companies? It's a multi-billion dollar industry.
Absolutely.
And they have convinced people that it's just a matter of choice and willpower.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they've changed their tune. They say, Oh, by the way, through an affiliate program, this is Weight Watchers and many other companies, you can get access to one of our affiliated practitioners who will prescribe weight loss medication along with our behavioral treatments.
Right.
Right?
Isn't Oprah doing something? Because she is an owner of Weight Watchers.
Yeah, they've
and
had
she's to, jumped on that
they've had
bandwagon.
To retool because
wow.
Who's going to want to use mere willpower and jump on a scale and go to meetings, you know, where they give you encouragement and or they sell you packaged food when you could just take a pill?
Yeah.
So they've had to get with the program, but they've changed their tune. They said, oh, it's a disease now. Ah. It's not your fault, you're fat.
Right.
It's like
medicalized.
We've medicalized it.
It's a diagnosis.
Yes, it's a diagnosis. And it, oh, and then insurers who are reluctant to pay for this because, can you imagine, if 40% of Americans are considered overweight or obese, actually, it's 40% obese and, you know, 60% overweight.
Oh my gosh.
You know, how many, we're talking tens and tens of millions of people taking these things. The amount of money that insurers and Medicare will have to pay to underwrite this will break the bank.
Right.
So they're trying to hold the line. Then you have a lot of organizations, you know, patient advocacy organizations are saying, no, this is not fair. Only rich people can take these drugs. Mm-hmm. What if you're a poor person? What if you're a minority person?
Right.
You have, which where there's a very, much higher percentage of obesity in the African-American community.
Yes.
You have the Congressional Black Caucus who is advocating for Medicare and Medicaid to pay for these drugs.
Yeah.
Because it's an equity problem.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So these are, this is going to come to a head.
And it's all going to come back to all of us paying because by more Medicare taxes, more higher higher health insurance premiums, we all wind up paying all of this.
So. I'm thin, I'm disciplined, I exercise. Maybe I'm genetically endowed, I'm lucky. But do I have to subsidize this for like somebody else?
Right.
Do
yeah,
I mean
that's a great question.
I mean, is it fair? I mean, it's like the student loan forgiveness.
Oh.
You know, it's like I paid
a debacle.
I paid off all my student loans. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, I had like a little, in those days you had like a little coupon book and every month it'd be like whatever, $200 and I'd pay, you know, a check to the government. Because the government loan, it was a great loan, and I'm, you know, I'm very happy that I mortgaged myself because I have a worthwhile and lucrative career. So so you know, it worked out.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I didn't stop after just getting an anthropology major because right now I might be walking around with a tin cup. You know.
Oh my gosh! So it's true, and the prices of these drugs, and now. More and more people are getting approved because it's been, I mean, you couldn't get it for weight loss. You could only get it for diabetes, but now you can get it for weight loss. And what does it do also to the bariatric surgeons?
Oh, yeah. I talked to one.
Yeah.
I interviewed one and he'd written a book about what's wrong with American medicine. And he says he's very happy to have people, do less bariatric surgery, because it's a medical
doctor.
Advance, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's also retired. So it doesn't hit him.
It doesn't hit him in the pocketbook.
He had his career in the heyday of bariatric surgery.
Yeah,
and you know he's comfortably retired now. He's happy for the advances that may spare people the consequences of bariatric surgery, which I think, all in all, probably are worse.
Yeah,
because people die on the table with bariatric surgery. There's a small but significant mortality rate with that surgery.
Yeah, and even after having bariatric surgery, you're set up with a lifetime of deficiency.
The weight can come back. The people can subvert the surgery.
That's true. We've seen that too.
Yeah.
It's really something.
So, anyway, all right. So more on that subject. If you go to if you haven't yet, subscribe to our newsletter because. Look, worst come to worst, you don't read every article. Fine, it goes to your inbox. Yeah, I know you got a lot of crap coming to your inbox. But, you know, it's if you find the topic relevant, you'll open up your email and read it. You know,
It just boggles the mind, to me anyway, that just looking at the side effects, the possible side effects. I remember being a hospital dietitian first when I was first doing my field work, seeing somebody with pancreatitis, and I said, oh, God, please never let me have that.
Oh, God.
Because it was horrible. Oh, it was excruciating.
Excruciating pain.
Oh, my goodness.
And you can't eat anything.
Do I want to take something that might cause that?
Yeah.
Do I want to do something? No, and then just the ileus, the bowel obstruction thing? That's frightening.
Yeah.
But, hey.
It makes constipation look like a walk in the park.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You think you're constipated? Hold on. Let me tell you.
About bowel obstruction.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
My gosh.
Anyway. So let's move on to a question. Let's take one.
Yeah, actually, we've got one here from our good friend Michael. Hi, Dr. Hoppen and Layla. You've said that in addition to helping remedy insomnia, melatonin has other benefits because it's also an antioxidant. I would be interested in your comments about Dr. Atiyah's article in which he says that one should only take a minute fraction of a milligram of melatonin, if at all. And we've got the actual article, which I've read. And Dr. Hoffman, he talks about that if you must take it at night, every night, you know, if possible, just use it as an occasional intervention. But the main reason I found here that Dr. Atiyah says to not take it, adhering to these guidelines depends critically on our ability to trust the amounts listed on the product label,
which is a concern. I've written about melatonin, and you know, let's comment on the melatonin thing, and then I want to talk a little more broadly about Peter Atiyah.
Yeah.
So what he's saying is that number one, it's unreliable, and there is a report that there's a lot of melatonin out there that's unreliable in terms it's either not enough or too much, you know, by many fold.
Yeah.
And that's why I urge people to go for mainstream brands, and that's also why, and I'll put in a little plug here. Use FullScript, please, because FullScript vets their products. They're the highest quality. And generally, they're not counterfeit products like you can get, you know, on Amazon.
Oh, my goodness,
where you never know what you're going to get.
Right.
It may be, you know, stuff that's been shoplifted for all you know.
Exactly.
And, you know, that is a thriving marketplace.
Or truly counterfeit.
Or truly counterfeit.
Yeah.
You know, because one of my colleagues, as I told people last week on the show, is, you know, he shared with me at dinner that he says, I got a problem. He says, they're counterfeiting my products. It looks exactly like my product. We had it assayed. There's nothing in it but rice bran, you know.
Oh, boy.
So anyway, what he says, Peter Atiyah says, is that because the body makes very minute amounts of melatonin, we should not mess around with melatonin at, you know, 3 or 5 or... you know, 10 or 20, because the effects are unknown of that stuff. And what I would say is that there's a point well taken, but you know, a lot of things that we do in medicine are what are called supraphysiologic. So when we take an SSRI medication, we dramatically boost serotonin above what serotonin is physiologically for the therapeutic effects. And we do that in a variety of ways. We do that many medications mimic the physiology of the body, but really amp it up, you know, a multiplicity of times.
Yes.
So blood pressure medications, psych meds, pain meds. I mean, we have what are called endorphins, but at very tiny levels. So we don't say, oh, let's give you a little endorphin because we're afraid that, you know, too much may not be physiologic and normal.
Yeah.
So I don't really follow that argument.
True.
But the other point is, you know, let's take a look at Peter Atiyah. And by the way, I listen religiously to Peter Atiyah. As many of you listen to this podcast, I don't need to listen to this podcast because I do it. So I like podcasts. I'm driving the car, and instead of aimless, you know, listening, you know, to, you know, 10-10 wins or something like that, or, you know, some rock station with 50 commercials, you know, I'll listen to something informative because I'm stuck in the car. And if I get stuck in a traffic jam, I don't mind as much because I'm learning.
Yeah.
When I walk to work, I tune out the sounds of the city, you know, with noise-canceling headphones, and I listen to an educational podcast. And one of the people I listen to is Peter Atiyah, and I admire him because he's absolutely brilliant. And his ability to, knowledge is encyclopedic. His ability to communicate it is excellent, and his guests give you a real deep dive on very interesting subjects. So, for example, I listened this morning on the way to a podcast where he interviews a urologist about treatments for prostate problems, you know, from prostatitis to benign hypertrophy to prostate cancer, and it's fascinating, and it's it's really good stuff. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to talking about things in the holistic realm, that's not his bailiwick or his orientation. And in fact, he has kind of a pejorative view of some of these things because he thinks they're weak tea. They don't really...
Would you venture so far as to say that it's not his expertise?
Well, it's not his expertise by his choice.
Yeah.
Because he has a bias.
Yeah.
Now, his bias, it's interesting. You look at his background, he spent a lot of time in surgical training. Mm-hmm. And, when it's kind of a personality test, what specialty you go into. Mm-hmm. If you're kind of a contemplative, cerebral kind of person, mm-hmm. You might go into internal medicine because you might want to learn about all the nuances of adult diseases. It's very complicated. If you want action and you're very decisive, mm-hmm. you want to go into surgery because surgeons fix things.
Right.
They're
right.
Mechanics.
They're technicians.
And, that did not appeal to me as much mm-hmm. because I have sort of a more, maybe nuanced background. Mm-hmm. This is not to say that in some ways Peter Attia is not nuanced mm-hmm. Because he's very sophisticated. But so what he is doing is he's actually has a practice where he does very, very aggressive prevention. Mm-hmm. And the prevention, in his mind, involves a lot of testing. He mm-hmm. recommends that people get frequent whole-body MRIs to find cancer early. And he recommends this in his new book, which is a bestseller called Outlive. Mm-hmm. He's really aggressive about colonoscopy. He thinks everybody should have a colonoscopy every 2 years after the age of 40. Mm. He thinks men should get a PSA every year after the age of 40. And on it goes. Yeah. And mammography for women, 35 at every year, and so on.
Okay.
So, and his argument is that if we find cancer early, we can treat it.
Yeah.
And is it same thing for cholesterol? And in fact, he cites his own example. He did some cardiac imaging and he found he had a plaque score that was like 5 or 7, mm-hmm. very low. But, he's relatively young. He's 50 years old.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm going to do something. So not only that, not only taking statins, he admits to taking PCSK9 inhibitors, which can actually annihilate your cholesterol. His cholesterol might be like, 103.
Yeah.
So he's very into, he's combining the certain aspects of primary care with the aggression of a surgeon, in my mind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. overly zealous and aggressive and overly confident in the predictive value of these tests and in the therapeutic options that are available to people when they find stuff. Because one of the problems with these early prediction tests is they're only as good as what you can do.
Yeah.
To address these problems. And, with cancer, we don't have all the answers. Mm. And so you can overdiagnose people mm-hmm. where the cancer might not have killed them. Sometimes I say to men, this is the cancer that might kill you at 108.
Yeah.
But you're going to die of something sooner.
Right.
Especially with slow growing prostate cancer, which the tendency these days is to do watchful waiting on.
Yeah.
And, it may be the case for other cancers. Not all cancers. I'm all for screening and prevention. I'm not a therapeutic nihilist. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, listening to this whole thing on prostate cancer, which is magnificent in certain ways, there's no discussion about the effects of lifestyle. There's no discussion of say you get prostate cancer, what supplements can you take or not take? Will they extend life?
Yeah.
There is a literature on that, but there's virtually no attention paid to that. Mm-hmm. So, I find he's a great source of information. I encourage people to listen to him, but with a big grain of salt. Because
chronic surveillance of your body.
Yeah.
Chronic.
Yeah.
Almost.
Because it's sometimes, there's an expression, if you're not up on it, you're down on it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case with something like melatonin. Mm. There's...
The other thing he says is that there's a lack of substantial evidence supporting its clinical benefits.
Well, I don't think that depends on your interpretation of the evidence.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, if you're not treating a lot of people as I do, you don't see that. You know, and I'm pretty sure that he's decided based on clinical evidence rather than on clinical practice that this is not something he's going to use. And incidentally, what's interesting is that on the basis of even less evidence than there is for melatonin, he's conducting an experiment on himself where he's taking an anti-aging medication. He's taking, what is it?
The rapamycin.
Rapamycin.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, very popular among anti-aging people, but really there's not that conclusive evidence in humans that it extends life. So that's kind of a leap of faith. I mean, is he not exceeding the body's endogenous production of rapamycin? You know, when he takes, you know,
good point.
You know, but he's cast his lot on, conventional therapies, whereas there's a bit of a blind spot to alternative therapies.
Yes.
So that's always what gets me.
And that's
me,
the bias.
Yeah. And it doesn't, by the way, it doesn't make me boycott him.
No.
And because I'm gaining so much useful information from him.
Oh, sure. And you're not going to be mad at him and not listen to his podcast anymore.
It's frankly like a conventional doctor who listens to my podcast and goes, well, that's kind of interesting. You know, I don't agree with this guy entirely, but it's kind of interesting, especially, you know, if he has evidence that some of these things work, you know, maybe that'll help me understand where my patients are coming from when they bring me long lists of the supplements they're taking, you know, rather than just throwing up my hands and poo-pooing it.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I have to say about that.
All right. Michael, thank you for that very thoughtful...
Oh, but you know, just cautions.
Yes.
I don't think melatonin's great for kids because there it may have some hormonal, neurohormonal effects.
Sure.
And, you know, in childhood development, it may not be that great. I don't think it's great for pregnant women to take, although they do have sleep problems, and maybe that's not the time to take it. Maybe in the case of kids with really serious sleep problems, you know, like kids with developmental disorders, you know, sleep-wake cycle problems, maybe give them some melatonin. If they have autism or autism spectrum, maybe that could be used, but I wouldn't routinely do it to, you know, put Junior to bed, you know, and give him some melatonin. I think that that may be a suitable caution,
you know. Right.
By the way, it has anti-cancer benefits. I think that's pretty definite. So at high doses.
It's a very, very important antioxidant.
And it's important antioxidant.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Although, you know, that controversy too. Some people say, well, we don't need antioxidants, you know. So, but, you know, that's everything in the field of nutrition has surrounded by controversy.
True.
All right. We've exceeded our time allotment for part one. I just wanted to get on my hobby horse and talk about that. But thank you for that question, Michael. It's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
And, okay, so when we return, give us a preview of the questions we're going to take up.
Does creatine raise blood pressure?
Okay, interesting question. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Layla Mutin, because it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And you can send questions, and we encourage you to send questions or comments, because if something you hear on this program, you know, drops a penny for you, as they say across the pond, let us know and share your opinion. Or your experience. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.